All right, Jeremiah 31, if you will, tonight. We're looking at four chapters. Really, if you put a title over these four chapters, it would be The God That Makes All Things New. All of the major prophets have a comfort section, an encouragement section, and we are right in the middle of Jeremiah's comfort section. Some prophets have longer ones than others, but Jeremiah is certainly powerful. It contains the new covenant, which I hope to get to tonight, and we'll see how we do. Okay, we're going to be looking at chapter 31 primarily tonight, exclusively tonight, actually. But let me review. We can stick some theological words in front of each one of these chapters. Like, for example, chapter 30 is redemption. It's really all about God promising these people there's someday there's going to be a new beginning. And he basically pictures what he's going to do with three basic illustrations. The first one is the yoke. He pictures a yoke around the nation's neck, just like they're a beast of burden pulling a plow behind them or in front of them. And he says, I'm going to break this yoke from off your neck. And, of course, the yoke is the picture of Babylon that they're going to be facing here in just a very short while. The second picture is this pus-filled, festering sore. This wound is grievous, ugly, disgusting, nasty wound. And God says, I'm going to heal your wound. All right, so if the breaking of the yoke, that's chapter 30, verses 4 through 11, the healing of this wound is verses 12 through 17. And then finally, he employs the image of a storm, a hurricane, a cyclone, whatever you call it, what you will. And he basically plays off of that in the rest of the chapter verses 18 through 24. And essentially what he is inferring is that he's going to calm the storm. There's going to be a massive storm, and they're going to be in it. But God's going to calm that storm, and everything's going to be okay eventually. Now, if chapter 30 was about redemption, chapter 31 is about reconciliation. They themselves are going to become a new people. God's going to redeem them from the bondage of Babylon and actually from the northern tribes, from the bondage of the Assyrians. But more than that, more than just being redeemed from that bondage, they're going to actually become a new people. You know, when we talk about any nation, a nation, especially Israel, maybe exclusively Israel, a nation is more than just its land. It's more than the cities that make up their constituency. A nation is about people living together. It's about them cooperating. They're working together. And it's about them, in Israel's case, it was supposed to be about them worshiping together. Now, in chapter 31, Jeremiah is going to describe these people, the people of God, and the new things that God's going to do for them. Now, chapter 31 is very interesting in that it's kind of all over the map, but what the prophet is doing is he's addressing three different entities. Now, they're all Jews, but here's how it breaks down, and it's really wild the way it breaks down. He's addressing, first of all, the United Nation, the nation as a whole, with all 12 tribes back together again. That's verse 1. And then you skip all the way down to verse 27 through 30. All right, so he's talking about the whole nation in those four verses. All right, and then he's going to talk about, secondly, the 10 northern tribes. All right, and that's in verses 2 through 20. He focuses only on the 10 northern tribes, which is really unusual because Jeremiah is writing primarily to Judah. He's a prophet sent to Judah and the captives. And then thirdly, he's going to address Judah in verses 21 through 26. So it's a strange configurement, right? He addresses the whole nation. He bookends the whole nation, verse 1, verses 27 through 30. Then he takes verses 2 through 20, the 10 northern tribes, and then 2 through 22, I mean. And then 2, 21 through 26, he is addressing Judah. So it's really an interesting breakdown of a chapter. So let's take it the way it's broken down, okay? First of all, he addresses the united people, okay? Now, we know that because of the sins of Solomon and the utter stupidity, the immature wickedness of his son Rehoboam, the Jewish nation divided, and they became basically essentially Israel, which has many different names, which I'll go over in just a second. Israel and Judah, all right, two in the south, 10 in the north. Two of the most depressing chapters, especially if you're a Jew, are 2 Kings 11 and 12 that talk about how this rift took place. But what Jeremiah is saying is that in the last days, the Lord's going to gather everybody back together again. He's going to unite them once again as one, and he's going to be the God of all of the families of Israel. Okay? Very, very encouraging to read verse 1. At the same time, saith the Lord, will I be the God of all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. All 12 back intact. In fact, God compared Israel and Judah to a seed that was going to be sown in the land, and it's going to produce not many harvests, not two harvests. It's going to produce one harvest. All right, so that's his commentary beginning in verse 27 on verse 1. All right, notice in verse 27, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and with the seed of beast. All right, so basically they're going to be one again without any question or any hesitation. So Jeremiah's ministry in the meanwhile includes breaking down, plucking up, as well as building and planting. I mean, when the book opens that way, back in chapter 1 and verse 10, Jeremiah, I'm calling you to tear down and to build up, right? And so Jeremiah himself now is talking about this ministry that God has given him here in chapter 31, okay? Up to this point, it's been primarily the breaking down so far. And now he's going to do the building up thing, the plucking up now, you see. Notice verse 28 of chapter 31. And it shall come to pass that like as I have watched over them to pluck up and to break down, to throw down and to destroy and to afflict, so will I watch over them to build and to plant, saith the Lord. Okay, so, yeah, that's what you've been doing, Jeremiah, and you're doing exactly what God told you that you were going to be doing right from the very, very beginning. No more blaming of the fathers, okay, which is exactly what happened in Ezekiel 18, first four verses, and then later on in that same chapter, verses 19 through 23, Deuteronomy 24, 16. Because each person is going to take responsibility for his or her own sins. There's not going to be nobody, there's going to be any, no more blame game. Okay, verse 29, in those days they shall say no more. The insinuation is that this is what's been going on. What's going to happen no more? The fathers have eaten a sour grape, and the children's teeth are set on edge. Everybody see, everybody's pointing fingers? But, verse 30, everyone shall die for his own iniquity. Every man that eateth the sour grape, his teeth shall be set on edge. Okay, so that's Jeremiah's message to the united kingdom. Okay, and that principle certainly had application to the remnant that returned to the land after the captivity, because it was the failure of the individuals in the nation to obey God, and it's everybody just breaking down at the same time. That's what caused their ruin. Okay, it wasn't the fact that a few were paying for the misdeeds of the many, or even vice versa. All right, if the kings and the priests had been like Josiah, if they had been more like Jeremiah, then the nation would have been saved, and nothing would have happened to them. Okay, so that's the message to a united people, verse 1 and then verses 27 through 30. Now in verses 2 through 20, you have a message to a restored Israel, the 10 northern tribes. Now what you'll notice if we read through all these verses, which we're not going to do, but if we read through all the verses, you would see words like Ephraim, all right, and Samaria. Those two words are references to the 10 northern tribes. They're kind of cue words, they're shortcut words, I'll call them what you will. They're the equivalent of the word Israel at this time in the nation's history. And the capital of the 10 northern tribes was where? It was in Samaria. Okay, that's where Ahab had his palace. All right, so notice where these words appear. Verse 4. Again, I will build thee, and thou shalt be built, O virgin of Israel. And what you have here is a lot of dancing and singing and merrymaking. That's really all a picture of the millennium. Millennial bliss is what they're looking at here, telescoping into the distant future. Verse 5, thou shalt yet plant vines upon the mountains of Samaria. All right, that's the 10 northern tribes. Verse 6, for there shall be a day that the watchman upon Mount Ephraim. All right, so Samaria, Ephraim, Israel, those are all synonymous for the 10 northern tribes. Okay. Now we know that those tribes were captured officially, historically, by the Assyrians in 722 BC. And they brought other peoples into the land, which produced a mixed race. The second most frustrating passage to read in 2 Kings, besides chapters 11 and 12, where the division occurs, is chapter 17, where you have these Jews who were supposed to be godly intermixing and intermarrying with all of these pagan heathens. And so when the people of Judah return to their homeland from the captivity, they're not going to have anything to do with any Samaritans. Anything to do with them. You read Ezra, and really Ezra is not primarily an anti-Samaritan book, but there's plenty of that there. For example, chapter 4 opens up with Sanballat sticking his nose in the Jews' business, and you know there's basically a war going on between Sanballat and the Jews. And then you get to like Nehemiah 2, and Zerubbabel is back building the temple, and the Samaritans say, well, we want to help. And Zerubbabel says, over my dead body, right? So this horrible thing takes place that was practiced clear into the New Testament. And it's not going to be dealt with until the Lord Jesus meets the Samaritan woman at the well in John chapter 4. And basically, she winds up getting saved, and then she goes back and tells her whole city, and there's a revival breaks out in Samaria. Of course, that's going to be a little bit short-lived, and it won't be until Philip the Evangelist comes in Acts chapter 8 and brings the gospel to the Samaritans, and you have a revival take place there beginning in Acts 8 verse 5 and following. But the hatred between the Jew and the Samaritan was kind of off the charts, really. But anyway, because the Samaritans established their own religion. They had their own temple. They had their own priesthood. They had their own mountain. And that aggravated the Jews all the more. It was tailor-made for pent-up hatred. Okay, now, all these promises that we would read in verses 2 through 22 for the 10 northern tribes, they don't apply to Ephraim, Israel, the 10 northern tribes after the captivity, okay? Because the Samaritans are not a part of the rebuilding of the land. Okay, those promises apply to the scattered 10 tribes. And don't ask me where they are. Nobody knows where they are. Only God knows where they are. And he knows how to summon them back together again. And he'll do it exactly as he wants to, and he'll do it in his time, in the end times, when he does call all the Jews together and restores them to their land. when they become one nation. And then the Samaritans are actually going to give up Mount Gerizim. This is our mountain, Mount Gerizim, the woman at the well tells Jesus. She's going to give up Mount Gerizim, and everybody is going to be on Mount Zion. Okay, everybody. Say, really? Yeah, verse 6. For there shall be a day that the watchman upon the Mount Ephraim, the reference to the mount there is Mount Zion, okay, shall cry, arise ye, and let us go up to Zion unto the Lord our God. All right, so they're going to transfer from Gerizim to Mount Zion. And everybody's going to be happy to do it. So Jeremiah is painting a picture for these people, okay? He's picturing God summoning his family together, and he's gathering his flock. He's leading them out of the desert and kind of into this fruitful oasis called Jerusalem, okay? And since none of that happened after the captivity, then the only thing that we can rightly assume is that it's eschatological. It's going to occur sometime in the end times when they look upon him whom they've pierced, when Israel repents and turns to the Lord, you see. Notice verse 18 of chapter 31. I have surely heard Ephraim bemoaning himself thus, thou hast chastised me, and I was chastised as a bullock, unaccustomed to the yoke. Turn thou me, and I shall be turned, for thou art the Lord my God. Surely after that I was turned, I repented, and after that I was instructed. I smote upon my thigh, I was ashamed, yea, even confounded, because I did bear the reproach of my youth. See, that's a commentary on Zechariah chapter 12, when all Israel will be saved, and they will mourn for him as they mourn for an only son. They look upon him whom they've pierced. So verse 20, is Ephraim my dear son? Is he a pleasant child? For since I spake against him, I do earnestly remember him still. Therefore my bowels will trouble for him. I will surely have mercy upon him, saith the Lord. And they will all be saved in a day. All 10 of those tribes will be saved in a day, without any doubt about it. So as you read, if we were to read all the promises, you notice the emphasis on the singing and the praising and the utter sheer joy of all this. This is the early millennial bliss that will be theirs. Now, an interesting thing happens in the book of Matthew, because Matthew actually quotes verses 15, 16, and 17 of chapter 31. All right, let's read those. Jeremiah 31:15. Thus saith the Lord, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel weeping for her children, refused to be comforted for her children because they were not. Thus saith the Lord, refrain thy voice from weeping and thine eyes from tears, for thy work shall be rewarded, saith the Lord, and they shall come again from the land of the enemy. And there's hope in thine end, saith the Lord, that thy children shall come again to their own border. So Matthew takes verse 15 particularly, and he cuts and pastes it into what becomes Matthew 2, verses 16, 17, and 18. Okay? Now remember, what's the fulfillment of this? Well, enter Rachel. Who's Rachel? Rachel is the mother of who? Joseph and Benjamin. Okay? Benjamin and Joseph. Joseph becomes the father of who? Ephraim and Manasseh, okay? Who actually become the two leading tribes of the 10 northern tribes. Ephraim was jealous. I mean, anytime anybody showed Ephraim up, they rose up and said, what's going on here? They wanted to be number one. In fact, the whole 10 northern tribes takes on the name of Ephraim, okay? And Manasseh had the biggest land allotment, and they were the most powerful of the tribes of the north. All right, two leading tribes. Genesis 30 actually affirms that, verses 22 through 24. So Jeremiah hears Rachel weeping at Ramah, where the Jewish prisoners were assembled for their long journey to Babylon. All right, so it's kind of like when Jeremiah says Rachel's weeping for her children, you almost have to go clear over to chapter 40 in verse 1 of Jeremiah, and the stage is set there, okay, where they're just about to be hauled off to captivity. So the descendants that came through Joseph, they'd been captured by the Assyrians, and now all of Rachel's descendants through Benjamin, okay, which is the southern kingdom, okay, Benjamin and Judah, they're going to Babylon. So Rachel's weeping for the ones going to Assyria. She's weeping for the ones going to Babylon, and her labor as a mother seems to have been in vain. By the way, what happened to Rachel when she gave birth to Benjamin? Yeah, she died in labor, right? So much so, I mean, God assures her that both Ephraim and Judah are going to be restored in verses 16 and 17, which you can see, which we've already read. And therefore, her sacrifice will not be in vain. What did Rachel initially name Benjamin? Anybody remember? Very good. Ben-Oni, son of my sorrow. And then Jacob changes the name to what? Ben-Yamin, son of my right hand, right? And it's really a picture of the Lord Jesus Christ. He comes into the world, he's described as a man of sorrows, but God exalted him and seated him at his right hand, where he will reign with the Lord forevermore. And it's just a tremendous picture. Jacob made Bethlehem a place of death, and then the Lord Jesus turns it into a birthplace. It's just really a very interesting undoing of the original seeming catastrophe associated with Rachel and the birth of her two children. Okay, that takes us to the last section of chapter 31, at least regarding this, where you have a restored Judah now. All right, verses 21 through 26 are all about Judah, the southern kingdom. So they're starting out for Babylon, and God instructs them, remember the roads, all right, set up markers along the way, along the route, because the people are going to use those same roads to get back home again. I want those markers in place. And so Jeremiah, what he's doing in these verses is he's depicting Judah as a silly little girl, okay, flirting around, gadding about with her from lover to lover. And now she's finally being summoned home. Now, Jeremiah has used this image before, right? We've talked about this before in chapter 2, first the opening of chapter 2, and then he brings it up again in verse 20 of chapter 2, and then the first 11 verses of chapter 3, all right? Actually, according to the Mosaic law, a daughter that prostituted herself should have received the death penalty, Leviticus 21 and verse 9. And then that was repeated by Moses in Deuteronomy 22:21. But God's going to do this new thing, all right? He's going to welcome her home, and he's going to absolutely, unconditionally forgive her. Now, let's talk about this phrase that we see in verse 22. How long wilt thou go about, O thou backsliding daughter? For the Lord hath created a new thing in the earth. A woman shall compass a man. Now, there's no end to the interpretations of what that verse is talking about. All right. And if you read all of the so-called experts, you will emerge confused. And to me, it always brought, what do words actually mean? Especially the original words. Those are the words that God breathed out. That word compass means it literally means to surround with care. It's like, here's the object of your affection, and you're going to just surround that thing with care. It's like what you do with a newborn child, right? You compass it about with blankets and pillows and just everything to make sure that it doesn't get bruised or hurt or anything like that, you know? This is the exact same word that God used in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 10 to point out how he had cared for Israel in the wilderness. It says in 32:10 of Deuteronomy, he found him in a desert land and in the waste howling wilderness. He led him about, he instructed him, he kept him as the apple of his eye. That word kept there is this word compass, right? Surrounded him with this tender, loving care, you see. And that word man, there's many different words. The word Adam is man. The word Gibor means mighty man. That's the word here for man in this verse. The Gibor, the mighty, the strong man, the champion. Okay? So the new thing that God is going to do is he's going to make everybody like champions, including the women. The women are going to be, you know, so strong that it's going to seem like almost like they're able to protect the men. All right? And then keep in mind that this is an amazing statement because Israel was a very masculine society. All civilizations back then were. In other words, friends, the return of the exiles is not going to be a parade of people looking like, you know, like a zombie apocalypse just occurred. You know, with ragged clothes and they've got soot on their face and they're just about half dead. You know, they're going to be alive and vivacious and powerful. The men are going to be powerful. The women are going to be vibrant and powerful. Everybody's going to come back triumphant, you see. It's going to be a march of warriors who were basically considered too weak to fight. I mean, they went out that way. They're coming back a different way, okay? So this is the picture of this future regathering of the people of Israel in the end times. They're going to enjoy a renewed land. It's going to truly be a land flowing with milk and honey. The desert shall blossom like a rose. Okay? The citizens will bless their neighbors in the name of the Lord. The farmers are going to actually get along with the city dwellers. Have you ever noticed how there's always this... All throughout human history, there's this conflict between country people and city people, right? And part of the promise of the millennium is that those stupid petty hatreds are going to stop. Okay, there's not going to be any feuding between farmers and city dwellers. They're going to all live together in harmony because of the blessing of the Lord. All right, now that brings us to the final nine verses of chapter 31. And let's see if we can get through it. It's about the new covenant, which we've been going over on Sunday mornings. So I'm not going to go into too much detail with it, except to remind you that what we've been doing on Sunday mornings in Hebrews 8 comes straight out of these verses. Okay? And it's important that you understand that. This is God's plan for the betterment of a human society. Okay? Is anyone else besides me sick of hearing people say that they're going to make the world a better place? Every time I hear that, honestly, it's like nails on chalkboard. It just grinds my hide, because any plan for betterment of human society that deliberately ignores and makes fun of the sin problem is absolutely destined to failure. I don't care how good your plan is, how great your urban renewal is. It's not enough to change the environment, because every single human heart is actually where the problem really is. All problems in the world are heart problems. And if God does not change the human heart so that they actually want to love God, so that they internally actually desire to do his will, then nothing good is ever going to happen. And so that's why the Lord announced a new covenant. It's going to replace this old covenant under which the Jews had lived really since the days of Moses. A covenant designed to direct their conduct, but which could never change their character. It just couldn't do it. It wasn't equipped to do that. It wasn't intended to do that. And Jewish history, friends, is actually punctuated with a number of old covenant renewals, right? A bunch of pep rallies to get the people back in tune with the old covenant, which did bring temporary blessing, but it never changed anyone's heart. The covenant itself did not change anybody's heart. For example, Deuteronomy records a renewal of the covenant under Moses right before the people enter the promised land. And I've been talking about that all this whole time we've been talking about Jeremiah. What chapters am I referring to? 28, 29, and then chapter 30 and 31 in Deuteronomy is the Palestinian covenant, or the land of Israel, which is part and parcel with the new covenant. Okay? So you had that in the book of Deuteronomy. Right before he died, Joshua says, "As I don't know about any of you, but as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord." So you have this rah-rah under Joshua in his last moments to reaffirm the covenant. And basically, Joshua 23 and 24 are all about that. All right. And then thirdly, Samuel calls the nation to renewal. Right? Renew your vows, Samuel says. And a whole chapter is given to that, 1 Samuel 12. And the ending of 2 Chronicles. First you have Hezekiah, chapters 29, 30, and 31. Hezekiah calls the people to a renewal of their commitment to the Mosaic Law. And then after Hezekiah, Josiah does the same thing in chapters 34 and 35. All right, so you have these revivals, these inspiring moments that were intended to bring the nation back to the Mosaic Law. But the fact that those blessings, those revival times, the fact that they didn't last really is not an argument against times of refreshing, right, as some have argued. I really have very little use for Billy Sunday. I know Billy Sunday is the hero of Bob Jones University, and I don't want to say too much bad about Billy Sunday, even though he didn't have the first idea how to preach. But when somebody told Billy Sunday one time that revivals weren't necessary because they showed up and then they just sputtered out pretty quickly, they didn't last, I just love what Sunday replied. He was really quick. He had a quick wit. He said, "A bath doesn't last either, but it's actually good to have one occasionally." So he's right, you know. I mean, those revival times didn't hurt. A nation that's built on spiritual principles that result in moral convictions, right? They need frequent times of renewal and getting brought back to the foundations, or the foundations will crumble. This is what we need as a nation, by the way, in the secular realm, to find out what an American actually is, instead of this new world order, this new worldview that's destroying America. Okay. Now, the new covenant is not another renewal of the old covenant. It's completely different. The new covenant has nothing to do with Mount Sinai, okay? It's a covenant that's new in every single way. It's what? It's inward. The old covenant was not inward, all right? God's law is not written on tablets of stone. It's written in the human heart. A good cross-reference that I regret not using in Hebrews 8 there was 2 Corinthians 3, that we're being renewed more and more as we look in a mirror and into the image of Christ. It's all internal, okay? And Ezekiel talks about this too, not just Jeremiah. Ezekiel, before Ezekiel even mentions the new covenant, in Ezekiel 11, he's talking about the need for internalness. And then the new covenant is in Ezekiel 36, when he talks about inside, right? The emphasis is personal, not national. And each person is putting their own individual faith in the Lord and receiving a new heart and with it a new disposition, a disposition that wants to be godly, that's not satisfied with anything less than that, you see. So the old covenant, it tries to control conduct. The new covenant, its purpose is to change character, by actually creating new life. That's how it changes character. So that people can actually love the Lord, can actually love one another, and do it willingly. They want to obey God's will. It's not like Paul says in Romans 3:20, by the law is the knowledge of sin. That's what the law does for me. It teaches me that I am deficient and that I need something besides myself. Under the new covenant, God promises, I will, look at verse 34. Here's the promise. And we just saw this last Sunday. Jeremiah 31:34. They shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, shall no one know me from the least of them to the greatest of them, saith the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity and I will remember their sin no more. Do you remember the three promises in Hebrews 8? Two of them are right there in verse 34. Hebrews 8:10, what's the promise? Internalization. Hebrews 8:11, what's the promise? Universality. Everybody that's saved is going to be in this condition. And then Hebrews 8:12, what's the promise? Unconditional, permanent forgiveness of sins. Okay? So that's the new covenant. And we have been made, we've grafted in to that original vine of Israel, and the new covenant belongs to us. Okay? And it's that covenant that the Jews are going to experience in these last days when they actually look upon him whom they've pierced and they repent and they actually all get saved in Zechariah 12, beginning in verse 10. What's the basis of the new covenant? Moses? The shed blood of Christ. No new covenant without the shed blood of Christ on the cross. Okay? What do you think Jesus was doing with Nicodemus in John 3? Did you ever think of it this way? I hope I brought it out when we worked our way through John 3. When he says you must be born again, that's all new covenant stuff, friends. That's Ezekiel 36. I'm going to put a new spirit in you. I'm going to put new life in you. Nicodemus, you're a leader. You're one of the fundamental leaders of all of Israel, and you don't know the new covenant? All right, that's John. That's the context of John 3:16. All right, so the Lord affirms the permanence of the nation and the faithfulness of his relationship to those people in the new covenant, particularly in verses 35, 36, and 37, which we do not have time to read. But you'll see, if you read those three verses, at least glance through them, you'll see that that's the burden of the message. This is a permanent nation I'm going to establish, all right? And we're going to be faithful to one another. It'd be easier for the sun to stop shining and the moon and stars to go out than for God to break his promises to his people Israel. The same way that Jerusalem was rebuilt after the Babylonian captivity, so it's going to be restored after the time of Jacob's trouble. God's going to put it back together again, and they're all going to be holy to the Lord. Every last one of them that gets saved at that time is going to be holy to the Lord. Universality of the elect. All right? Okay, obviously there's tons more we can say about all this, but I think we hit the highlights. All right?